Hey there, this is Matt Ligeti, your favorite comic book Yeti. Did you know that if enough people listen to this podcast, advertisers give us money? Money we can then use to, say, pay our journalists. It's wild. Totally unrelated, we make this podcast using Anchor by Spotify. If you haven't heard about Anchor by Spotify, it's the easiest way to make a podcast with everything you need. All in one place. Even Grant can do it, and he's a grandpa when it comes to technology. Love you, Grant. Let me fill you in on what some of us in the industry call reasons to believe. Anchor has tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. When hosting on Anchor, you can distribute your podcast on listening platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcast, and more. And they make it super easy. It's everything you need to make a podcast all in one place. And best of all, Anchor's totally free, which is great when you're, say, a comic book journalism website who lives on donations and boyish charm. Download the Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. And hey, I love you.
You are listening to Into the Comics Cave with your host, comic book heartthrob, Grant Stoy.
Hello, again. You're listening to this in the new year, which is awesome. Thank you. Still don't know why, but thank you. And today, we have on not just an award-winning comic writer, and not just a Wu-Tang enthusiast, but a role model. Dare I say, we have Jared Luhuan. How you doing, Jared?
I'm good. Role model is not something often thrown around. So yeah, I'm really sailing high now.
I think you need to start like having an online shop with a shirt that just said Jared is a role model.
Yeah, so my mom would probably buy that out. If I just need to like have the one, you only need one good customer, you know?
It's true. And one thing about Jared that everyone knows is that Texas born and bred. So I want to hear all about the born and well, maybe not the breeding part, but the born part. Let's go into, like, where'd you grow up in Texas? Did you grow up in Texas?
I did. I was born and raised in Del Rio, Texas. It is a relatively small, it's I don't know, to Texas small is like, there's 10 people that live here. So it's got like 10,000, 15,000 people. And it's like 3 miles from the Mexico border. I always describe it as technically the United States, but basically Mexico. And it's got the biggest man-made lake in Texas, Lake Amistad. Shout out Lake Amistad.
Really?
Yeah, it's a really weird point of pride, but yes, that is true.
Do you know what the point of making that lake was?
No. I really wish I did right now because I brought it up, but I think it was built in part of a water sharing treaty with Mexico. So it helped control, not the Rio Grande, but some other river, maybe the Rio Grande. I don't think so. Cause the Rio Grande's kind of dirty, but so I'm pretty sure that's why it was built there. Cause they share water from each other. Mexico and Del Rio, they have like a deal, but.
Oh, that's rad.
Yeah. It's wild, right? Droughts.
Oh gosh. So did y'all get to like, go across the border and just like kick it up and then come back?
Yeah, we did that a lot when I was a kid. My parents and I would go over pretty regularly. I would say every other weekend, at least once or twice a month, we'd go. When the cartels moved in when I was in high school, I one day we'll talk about my cartel stories, but not today. But when they got bad, we stopped going. I did go as a teenager a couple times to drink Tsar Mom, and that was kind of cool. But mostly, like, it was pretty – I never had too many terrifying experiences with the cartel. But yeah, after, like, it did get pretty bad while I was in high school. Nobody was going over by the time I graduated.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah, I think they've chilled that out because the cartel doesn't really care about Acuna anymore, which is the sister city from Del Rio. They're more interested in smuggling through, like, El Paso and it's El Paso and some other one I can't think of, further south than Del Rio. But that's kind of like their preferred routes now. But yeah, I grew up knowing a lot of undocumented people, which is really blows people's minds, because it was always just like that we had friends where if you were getting in trouble and you were trying to like hide away from the cops because we were doing hood rat stuff, it was like, hey, you can't go to so-and-so's house because his grandma will get deported. So we were like, okay, you know, and that was just common knowledge amongst our friend group. So that was, yeah, Del Rio is like a really cool place. It's really nice. And it has like the best Mexican food on this side of the border. It also has a really crazy good burger place called Salas. It's so good. It's so good. I know that's weird, but it's really, really good.
Well, I mean, I want to hear about the Mexican food. Like, I'm not disparaging the burgers at all, but I want to hear about like the tamales that you guys used to have.
Oh, dude. Yeah, so let me, speaking of tamales, let me tell you, this is a good story for Del Rio. My dad, I had moved out. I was living in where I live now in West Texas. I went down to see my dad, to see my parents, and I was like, oh, you know, are we going to get tamales? And he was like, yeah, we'll get some tamales while you're here. And then later on, like without saying anything, he's like, hey, you know, let's go to HEB. And I was like, okay, HEB is like a local Texas grocery store. So we go, right, and we park off to the side of the HEB. And I'm looking at him, and I'm like getting ready to get out of the car. And he's like, no, wait. And I was like, okay, you know, what's going on? And he goes, no, we're just waiting. We're just going to meet someone. So this car with Mexico license plates pulls up, right? And my dad gets out. And my dad, Spanish was his first language, so they're speaking Spanish. I speak almost no Spanish, so I don't know what they're talking about. And I see him give him cash, and the guy gives him, like, a bag. And my dad comes back to the car. And I was like, did I just watch you buy drugs? You know, like, that's a real option, you know? And he goes, what? And he gives me the bag, and it's two dozen tamales.
Oh my gosh.
We're buying from somebody who's from Mexico who has them in their van.
That sounds amazing.
And they were very good. They were very good.
Like, being a northern white person, I don't get as much good Mexican food as one would imagine, if you can believe it. So like living vicariously through that is just lovely.
You, I think, like, if you ever, Del Rio is like cool for a lot of reasons. If you really like fishing, that could be your bag. But no, dude, every time I go, I have like my wife and I have an itinerary, and I'm like, these are the restaurants that I have to eat at.
Yes.
Now I have to go to Chinto's, I have to go to Marcelino's, I have to go to Sala's, and I'm like, and she's like, okay, like, you know, we'll figure it out. And I'm like, I have to, I can't. I'm gonna have to stay another day if we don't hit all these places. So.
Like, what was it like growing up in a place like that? I imagine just, gosh, it sounds lovely. So,
it was rough. It was rough. So like part of Del Rio has a really, if you're, I was a problem kid, right? I was in trouble a lot. Everybody knew that I was a troublemaker, and like I was doing things I shouldn't have been doing and I had no business doing, but. So, like, the thing is when you're that kid, everybody knows and has no problem talking about you in a derogatory way. And that sucked. So, like, you know, when I was 14, I had a teacher flat out tell me she didn't believe I was going to graduate high school. Like, we're in class.
Oh, what?
She's like, yeah, no, like, you're not going to college. You're not going to graduate high school. Like, let's move on. And so that stuff like was rough because it's a smaller town. But I love visiting a lot as an adult. I think that I like it more as an adult than I did ever as a teenager. Cause like, I'm not there all the time, you know, like I'm not there to get in trouble, but So it was really nice. And like the thing about Del Rio that I never expected until I moved is that Del Rio is predominantly Mexican, right? They're span every, I can't even tell you how many, I had to learn how to order Burger King and McDonald's in Spanish because people there just couldn't take your order in English. Oh, wow. And it's really crazy because I thought that was how it was everywhere, right? I just thought Mexicans were everywhere. And then I moved to West Texas, and where the demographic is completely flipped, and it like shocked me, right? Like it blew my mind that Mexicans weren't in all the places I thought they were. So it was really, but that's cool though, right? Because like if you have to grow up being that ingrained into your culture, into your history, and that's kind of cool. Like I have a lot of appreciation for that. But it was really at 18 realizing that it's not just TV, the white people are literally everywhere, you know. Oh, yeah. It's wild. Yeah.
You can't throw a stone without hitting a white person.
I know. And they're, I got like all my, I think I'm the only, my wife says that I'm not, but I'm pretty sure I'm the only Mexican in our neighborhood right now. And that always makes me a little nervous. And she tells me that she always sees them, but she never sees them when she's with me. So
that's convenient.
Yeah. Yeah. Who are all these secret Mexicans that are hiding from me? You know, like.
So I'm curious, when did like the troublemaking start? And was that kind of just like a product of being in a smaller community?
So I was like getting into trouble when I was 14. I got bullied real bad as a kid, and it made me really angry and resentful. And my goal was, right, when I started getting in trouble, I started noticing people were like, oh, like this guy sucks, Jared's worthless. And so I was just like committed to the bit, right? Like I was just like, okay, cool. And yeah, I just got like really focused on angrily proving people right, I guess. I don't know. Cause I didn't, cause like I graduated high school. I went to college, you know, I have 2 degrees. And so I don't know if like that's a thing that what I did very well, but I was just a really angry kid. My parents both worked super hard, and we weren't like, I wasn't poor until I moved and I was poor in college. But I was just like getting in, and that's like, I'm committing crimes because I want to, you know,
there's no
capacity. I'm just a bratty kid looking to cause trouble. And so, but it's fine now. Like I got over that, obviously, you know.
Yeah. And when did that switch kind of flip for you?
I don't know if it really flipped until I was 25. Right. Because it was 2016. And I've been really public about, I had like a real depression problem, right? And I almost made some very bad choices. Mm-hmm. And because I was angry, and I had like lived my whole life with this anger being the driving point, right? That I got to this point where there wasn't anything to be angry about, right? I had done the things people said I wasn't going to be able to do. So what do I do now, right? Because mm-hmm. there's nothing to oppose. And I got super lost. Had a big existential crisis, and I ended up doing. That was when I realized that I had to like make a change as to who I was as a person, and that's when I started therapy. And and my therapist was super awesome, and she was great, and she really helped me realize all these things that I had built up, how I dealt with traumas, how I had developed all these resentments and all this, where this anger was coming from. And unfortunately, like, you know, I'm not sitting here saying I'm like, you know, an all-star of mental health, but she definitely like helped me not just figure out how to deal with things better and to let some of that stuff go, but to like push myself with something that isn't just the negativity, right? Doing it because I want to. And that's like one of those really important life lessons I didn't fully grasp until then.
And when did the arts kind of enter your life? Because like that, and that's including like music and writing.
Yeah. So my mom's a teacher. And so I've been reading since she could make me. we read completely different stuff, which I always think is really funny because I try and get my mom books that I think she'll like and that I think I really like and I think she'll like, and she hates them all the time.
Oh.
And yeah, but we just have completely different tastes. So I was reading since I was a kid. I was really into novels. I was not a Harry Potter kid. Thankfully.
Yeah.
Hindsight. But I got like really into Star Wars and like I think like movies and books was like my ground base of where everything else came from, right? I obsessively watched movies. I would read anything I could get my hands on. Music really hit me when I was 14. And I think it hit me at 14 because so like I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life at that age, but I knew I couldn't play music. I knew that was not an option for me. Like,
was that lack of trying or?
No, I tried guitar. I never even tried a guitar. I would never in my life be able to convince my mom and dad to get me a drum set. So I tried bass and I was an okay bassist until I realized I wasn't playing it correctly. So it was actually like I was lessening it. And I can't sing. It's awful. So my whole bit was this is something that's so far out of my grasp. And that's what I love about it is that I can't do this, you know, like I feel like if I really applied myself, I could probably, you know, carve out a statue, you know, but I could maybe paint something decent, but I can't write music at all. And at 14, I was angry. So it was all a lot of metal. And when I got into my 20s, I switched gears into listening to more hip hop, but like, I'm a real diehard fan of blues. I really like soul. But I have like weird music taste. It's predominantly, you know, hip hop and but there's like also like James Brown and Muddy Waters and Eric Clapton. I don't really listen. There's bands, metal bands I still really like. I just don't listen to it as often as I did.
That's awesome. So when did you try your hand at creating, at writing?
I think I wrote, I've always been something of like, I've always liked writing. When I was a kid, I wrote a story about a guy who became a shark and ate my childhood enemy.
No, this sounds great.
It was awesome. You know, and the best part about having a teacher for a mom is that the teacher knows her phone number right then and there. So she can call her and tell her, hey, your kid just drew a shark devouring his childhood nemesis. So that was fun. But I think like I got really serious about writing when I was about 16, 17, where I was like, this is something that I really like doing. I really enjoy. I like storytelling in general. Right. And that's usually what I'm doing when I'm sitting around with people is that I really like listening to people telling stories and telling them in turn. And so that's where I figured out that I wanted to do it. I didn't get serious about it until I was 25, whenever I figured everything else out. You know, I did not believe up until that point that writing was even an option for me. I was really good. So one of my degrees is in philosophy and my professors were really into my writing and kept telling me that. And I really wanted to do something like that. And I almost went and got my PhD in philosophy and some things.
Oh, wow.
I had gotten a really nice offer, but some things went wrong with it. And then I have my other degree is in political science, and I was going to go into working for advocacy groups because I did some immigration rights activism during my college years. So I wanted to go into something like that. And all I could find is unpaid internships in cities that cost like 10 times where I live.
Of course.
So that was not an option, right? Because my parents couldn't pay for me to not have a job for 6 months. So then I was like, I figured out all that stuff and I was like, man, I really love writing. I should give it like an honest chance. And I gave everything writing a chance to like figure out what I wanted to do it in. And it comics, because I had read a lot of manga when I was a teenager. I had read Western comics, and I'd been reading, you know, Western comics for most of my adult life. And I couldn't get into prose. It's just not something that I have fun with. It almost feels like a chore more than I'm enjoying it. But I had the opposite effect when I was doing comics. When I was writing scripts, when I write scripts now, I can easily lose 4 or 5 hours out of my day because I'll just sit there and knock it all out. And that's where I had a lot of fun with that. I've had a lot of fun during the whole process of pencils, pen, inks, colors, letters. I really enjoy the editorial experience too. Every part of the whole making process is something that I just have like a wealth of fun in. And as I've gotten better in comics and have found more of the nuance in it, I've enjoyed it like twice as much. And so it's just something that I couldn't stop doing.
What was it like the first time you got a page back from an artist?
Like, it was like seeing light for the first time, right? Cause it's literally like that came from here, right? Your brain imagined something and somebody else brought it into existence. This thing doesn't exist without the certain synapses of your fucking brain working in the right spots. And so it just blew my mind. Like the way that it, something could come from like your imagination fired off into something real. It was really blew my mind. And the script was awful. It was terrible, but it was, I don't know if I have it around here, but I still have a page from that that I just kind of look at every now and then to remind myself of that first time.
What may I ask what that first comic was?
So it was a pitch called Hunters, right?
And I'm interested.
Yeah, it was about, oh man, this story sucks so much. So when I wrote it, I had just started therapy. So I was still really mad. And the story was about these two kids. They get into a shelter right as a bunch of nuclear bombs drop across the United States. And it's an older sister and her little brother. And they're like in this bunker, and they finally realize that it's actually a military facility, because of course, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. And the whole plan of the military is to keep everybody underground. And then in like 5 years, they come back out and they rebuild the country and exact vengeance. I don't know. I'm sure I had a plan then. I don't remember what it was, but she, like the older sister, ends up having to become like this trained killer. And she gets like out of this tunnel for the first time in 5 years. And in like 2 days, her brother dies.
What the fuck, dude?
And it, yeah. So, and the whole thing is about how her failures, she spent all that time preparing for something only to fail immediately. And so it's about her on this weird quest of trying to get vengeance on the people that killed her brother, while also trying to like figure out what she was going to do with herself, and how like, it was like I think I had it planned for like 15, 20 issues, and she was going to wind up like keeping trying to fight something until there was nothing left to fight. And then she was going to die. And it was angry and weird and not all that original, and rest in peace. But the art was fantastic.
I was going to say, if modern Jared takes a swing at that, I think that might actually be good, because all that like character work sounded good.
Yeah, like I thought it was a funny twist too, right? Like the brother is like dead at the end of the first issue, right? You really think this is a whole thing, and it was good. But I don't know. I don't know if modern Jared could write it. You know, I feel like that's one of those angry, super angry man things. And I don't know if I could do that as somebody who's like got a kid now, has a wife, has a bunch of animals. And yeah, sometimes life kind of sucks, but usually it's pretty awesome, you know? And so I don't know if I like could commit to being like mad, you know?
Also, like finding that headspace again would be really trippy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like Mario Candelaria and I have talked a couple times about getting into this headspace for your characters. And usually I'm writing mine like with a pretty close line of separation. Like usually all my characters are just parts of me in some way. And, but yeah, I don't know if I could ever, I don't know if I'd want to dredge all that up, but I don't think I could. I really don't. I'm like three times happier than I've ever been, even on my worst days now, which I sometimes need to remind myself. but like, I'm just not that angry. I'm just chilling, you know?
What was the first book that you put out that you were like, this is the hot shit. I like this. That you're not like critical of now.
I think that Dryfoot issue number 3 is the issue that I still think is one of my best written works yet. Like I'm proud of everything. There's obviously like all writers like things that we were critical of. But I read issue 3 from Dryfoot anytime that I get like really in my own head. And I'm always like, it's a banger, you know, like all of that shit got set up. All of that. There's like one of my favorite parts, right, is that they can, if you haven't read Dryfoot, spoilers, you should have already read it. You should feel bad for not reading it. But
absolutely.
There's a scene in it where, she's my favorite character, and I can't remember her name.
Mari,
yeah, Mariana. She picks up a gun, and she aims it at the villain. And the villain says, you shouldn't put your finger on the trigger unless you're actually going to pull it, because he doesn't believe she's going to, right? And then a few pages later, there's a tug of war between two friends over a gun, and their finger, one of their fingers is on the trigger, and in the accident, it pulls, and it fires, and it kills them. And I'm so abundantly proud of that sequence because it I think it's like a really good case of me burying the lead. Like it's there. That's like a relevant line. It's just not in the way that you think. Mm-hmm. And I'm super proud of that moment. I really do think that was like, that's my best written issue or probably book period. Like if I had to choose one, So spoilers, but also by Dryfoot.
Seriously, I remember messaging you after I read that issue, and I was like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah. I could not believe Mad Cave let me do that. I really thought that was one of those, like, just my intrinsically rebellious nature, right? I was just like, there's no way they're going to let me kill a kid in this book, right? And then they did. Nobody stopped me. Like, nobody even questioned it. They were like, this is awesome.
Hello there. My name is Don Cardenas, and I'm here to invite you to check out my podcast, the 2021 Granty Award-winning Comics Coffee Metal, where I interview creatives in, around, and about the worlds of, you guessed it, comics, coffee, and metal. I've already had such amazing guests on my show, including, but not limited to, Liana Kangas, Mike Norton, John O'Diener, Michael Conrad, Sophie Campbell, Guitar Max Carlisle, Andrew Baina, and of course, the Word Bros themselves, Bob and Kevin. Comics Coffee Metal is available on all the major podcast services, and you can find it directly at comicscoffeemetal.com. I hope to see you there, and now I return you to Into the Comics Cave with the amazing, awesome, talented, tall, handsome, what else did I say? Definitely over 6 feet tall, smells good like lavender and motorcycle grease. Is that right? Motorcycle grease? All right. Grant Stoy. There, I said it. Get my money now.
So, Jared, I got a question. Do you think it's fucked up that Goof Troop poses the quest or the scenario that Disney characters can achieve climax?
No. I feel like we should presume all characters can climax. Unless they're dating Batman, which is
obviously
a deep Twitter discourse joke right there. But or unless they like explicitly say so, we should always presume that every character we see in any media is capable of climaxing.
Really?
Yes. Even Sylvester the Cat. And especially Foghorn Leghorn.
See, this just gets into weird territory where it's like, that assumes that My Little Ponies, they can achieve climax.
I'm sure there is a My Little Pony fan out there that can prove they do with some fanfic.
Oh, God. I feel like that's Pandora's box that needs to clamp shut.
We're two Google searches away from having way too much information.
So, man, I didn't expect you to take like this galaxy brain approach to the is it fucked up question. That's, I think you just blew my mind.
It's got to be, you got to take the route less traveled, you know?
So now we got to dive into this a little bit further. So when Goofy has Max, like that's just, one has to assume straight up birds and bees, vaginal birth. But if Donald Duck were to knock up Daisy Duck, there would be an egg involved, correct?
Yes.
Do you think that's kind of fucked up? That a talking thing comes out of an egg?
Well, we come out of eggs, right? Just not in a shell, right?
I mean, if you wanna get like real nasty about it, yeah.
How many degrees from eggs are we all? You know, like, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't have. I consider myself something of like a cultural anarchist, right? Like, I'm like, there are. Let's just do like the craziest possible shit. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we're all. It's all just degrees of eggs, man. I'm good with that.
Yeah, Mickey Mouse Fox.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope so. If you have to walk around singing and dancing for the enjoyment of children, I feel like you should be able to climax.
And also, going back to Duck Anatomy, we're assuming that Scrooge McDuck, Donald Duck, all the other male ducks, they have corkscrew penises.
Yeah, yeah, I did not expect that fact right off the top of your head.
It's one of the things that Jay Sheck and I bonded over, was talking about curly dongs.
That's the least surprising response. Like, if I had to pick two people to discuss that would be the combination I would choose.
Oh, so now that's out of the way... We are going to hammer down the door of the five questions we ask every guest. These are questions that we based off of James Lipton's Inside the Actors Studio. Are you ready?
Yeah.
So, number one, what is your personal favorite sequential art sound effect?
Okay, this is a really specific example.
I love it.
There is, I believe it is the final issue of Assassination. I don't remember who wrote it, but I know Erica Henderson did the art, right? Okay. And at the end, when they're killing the main bad guy, there's a panel where the trigger's pulled, the bullet's firing, there's blood splatter, and in big letters behind it, framing this gunshot, it just says "fucked." And the idea that that's sort of the sound effect, that's my all-time favorite.
That's a good one. I love it when like the action or the verb itself gets turned into the effect.
I love that. I think that's the coolest thing. And when it works, like, I don't know if you've read Assassination, but they do that often. And it's really funny and it works super well. And I think that's probably one of the things I've stolen from like outright, is that I try and in sound effects, I'll try and slip in, you know, like actual verb sound effects. Cause I think it's funny. And I think it just breaks it up. Sometimes you can only type boom and bang and wood so many times. You gotta throw in a fucked.
Yeah. And kind of trailing off of that, what's something about the medium of sequential art that you love?
That I love. I really love collaboration. I think that's honest to God my favorite part. I really like working with other people on something, but like on the other side of the book, right? As a reader, I like that comics has this unique ability to pause on a moment that other art forms like film, TV, you know, things like that, kind of blink and you miss it. Even video games, you know, like it happens and it's gone. I like that comics have it where you can kind of sit there and marinate on a moment. If anybody who's read Saga has had those moments where you're just kind of like looking at this page and what's just happened and kind of just letting it soak in. I think that's such a unique thing to comics, and it makes it such an interesting and fascinating medium because of that.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that coin, what's something about sequential art that you dislike?
I hate the industry.
Yeah.
It's, you know, without going into any details, there's a lot of predators in this industry, and they're out, and not just ideas, right? Because we saw there's a lot of men who have been real nasty in comics as well. But this industry is full of people who want to take advantage of you. And that sucks, because there's a lot of people doing really amazing work. There's a lot of people doing just brilliant comics work that I don't think get anywhere near the credit they deserve. And it makes it harder for, I think, newcomers that are coming up in the industry. Like, that itself can feel like a giant wall. I had a person reach out to me about a contract for a publisher that they wanted the publisher, if you couldn't deliver, they weren't going to pay you anything. And if you couldn't deliver the book, you'd have to pay them $100.
How does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's what I told him. I was like, bro, don't even sign that. And he was like, well, I guess I can talk to a lawyer and see if they'd be willing to take it out. And I was like, no, tell them to go fuck themselves and put that shit on Kickstarter, dude. If you're gonna pay for the whole thing, do it your own way. Like, don't fuck that. You know, there's things like that, and it sucks because there's probably a lot of really talented people that are getting kept out of our industry, and we're going to hurt for it in the long term. But, you know, I think that's just kind of the dark side of capitalism, right? Like, maybe everything kind of sucks. So, I don't know. But yeah, that's my least favorite part.
Gotta love late stage capitalism.
Yeah, amen.
So I got some bad news for you. We just found this car that you were sitting in, and you actually choked to death on an illegal, ill-gotten tamale.
Oh, man, yeah. That's the most believable cause of death you've ever given me.
Yeah, just we traced it back to this unmarked van that drove up from Mexico. It's really weird. So you're dead. Let's say you go to heaven. You show up at the pearly gates, and you're greeted by Jacob Kurtzberg, a.k.a. Jack Kirby, the godfather of comics. And what do you hope he says to you?
That Mexican with sword shit is dope. that's all I want. And then we would dab it up, you know, and he would be down with it. That's all I want from Jack Kirby. God bless him.
And if we could just tangent a little bit, like the evolution of the flippant "I want to see Mexican with swords" comment on Twitter to actually making that comic was just staggering. It was so cool.
Yeah, I'm a crazy person, and I was like, you know, maybe I'm going to write a pitch for something like this, and then I was like, you know what? No, this is for the people. We got to crowdfund it, and but that was probably the craziest sequence, like 7 month, you know, Twitter basically got me to write a book. Now I'm writing a follow-up, so I guess that's what I get.
Well, dude, thank you so much for joining us. Where can folks find you on socials?
Yeah, so on Twitter and Instagram, I'm at Jared Lujan, JarrEdLudan. And you can also go to my website at Lujan Writes, Writes Like a Pen, .com, and you can sign up for my newsletter. I haven't sent one out this month, so hopefully by the time you hear this in 2022, I've got my shit together. I'm putting it out again, but I put like a bunch of like sneak peeks and stuff, and so I'll have stuff to show in January as well. So yeah, fun times. And believe in yourself.
Hey, where can people go if they want to give you money?
You can buy. Oh, so we're about to have. We don't have a store open yet, but All the Devils Are Here will be opening a storefront in January 2022, I believe, if everything goes according to plan. So if you missed out on our Kickstarter, you can always just go and check that out right now. Otherwise, you know, live your life.
Oh, yeah. Well, dude,
I need a Venmo if I can plug it then. You know, I don't have a Venmo because I don't understand technology.
Dude, it's all wacky, but we will find a way to put money in your hands. And in the meantime, thank you for putting your voice in my ears.
Thank you.
This has been a Comic Book Yeti production. You can find new episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and anywhere podcasts stream. For more information on the Comic Book Yeti, please visit comicbookyeti.com. And for more of Grant, visit grantstoy.com or on Twitter at Grant and Stuff.